And we have a rare treat this evening. We have Peter Matheson, one of America's truly great writers, written short stories, travel literature, historical works, novels, essays, children's books of the 30 or so that you have written. The Snow Leopard won the National Book Award. Others of yours have been finalists for the National Book Award. One of the founders of the Paris Review of Literature. It's a pleasure to have you here at our symposium. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Dean. Very happy to be here.
Now, Peter, it seems that over the 30 or so books that that you've done, and over the years that you've been writing, it seems like your best gift in writing is your ability to observe. You have some very, very keen observation skills, it seems to me. But those observations seem to have this underlying concern for whether it's habitats or species or groups of people who cannot defend themselves and cannot speak for themselves. Is that a conscious thing as you developed as a writer? Was that conscious, or was that just something that became a theme in your work?
It started pretty early. I mean, I've always been very, very concerned. First, really, with it's sort of a funny thing, because I've always been interested in how we've treated our native people, American Indian people, which isn't very well, by and large. And I discovered that there's American Indian character in virtually all my early books and in my nonfiction too. So it was obviously something that was in my head. And it wasn't entirely, I wasn't sort of thinking about it. I wasn't even particularly well read on it, but it seemed to be there. And it seemed to me it went right along in worrying about the whole natural world. It was the natural North America, the New World that we, all the first people who came here talked about, this great paradise on Earth, And we were not treating it well. The earliest book I did on wildlife is called Wildlife in America, and I actually talk quite a lot about Indian people in there too, because I'm just showing the areas where they are and how they were already in very early colonial times were noticing the big decline in wildlife and the animals that were available to hunt or to see or whatever. They were the first people to kind of say, hey, what are you doing? We can't even hunt anymore. And so that those two concerns, always went together. And I'm interested in traditional people all over the world. I always have been. I think it's very sad about, I was reading in your magazine today about the loss of languages. We're losing languages all over the world, a mile a minute, just small groups. You get little clusters of people, and they don't relate anymore, or they're in the wrong clan or something. And this sort of needless loss, of traditions and cultures and wildlife and clean water and clean air. And so this is my way of protesting something that's, I find, very, very painful.
So it's a conscious protest on your part.
It is now. I think at the beginning it was kind of almost instinctive that I thought something was out of balance. I remember I had a wonderful book that was written by Rachel Carson, a terrific writer, probably the best, one of the very best natural history writers on top of Silent Spring and everything that our country has ever had. But she's writing, and she's in a correspondence with another nature writer, a very good one, Sally Carragher, her name was. And she was saying that she's noticing the same thing, this phenomenon of things we're losing, this heedless destruction of our natural habitat and our world and our native people. That she awoke with a kind of a sadness every day. It took her a little while to kind of get her spirits back up again, because it just is a pervasive kind of despair that we were doing so little about it. And needless to say, I've not improved our record in the last few years.
But Peter, isn't that just the natural evolution of things, though? Things bubble up, things go away. Isn't that the way it is?
The dinosaurs went extinct too, but
yeah,
and they went extinct virtually overnight. That was kind of interesting. That was a natural phenomenon. Many, many species have gone extinct. It isn't just that. Things have gone extinct. Everything comes and goes eventually. But not at this speed. Not at this speed. It's become absolutely... Edward Wilson, E.O. Wilson, he writes about that a lot. And this is what the scary part is, that we're losing species so fast. Often very species that would be very useful for science, you know. I was reading the other day, or I saw it maybe on the TV, on one of those nature shows, you know, we're losing our coral reefs. About 50% of the coral reefs all around the world now are in a state of crash. And just as we're doing that, they're discovering extraordinary medicinal properties in these little animals. And just as we want to sort of harvest them for medicine, they're disappearing due to other activities of ours. It's all, you know, it all comes back to us. We're the first species that ever extinguished another species. We're pretty sure of that. We are the first species that ever did, and we've done a lot of it, you know.
And that does seem to be a theme of a lot of what you write, is that the human encroachment into habitat and into either other civilizations, that's been one of your themes throughout your whole writing life.
It has been. You asked that question. I didn't mean to start off on a note of gloom or anything like that.
Well, let's continue on the gloom here, because you got a pretty heady start as a young writer. You sold your first short story to The Atlantic. You know, nobody does that. And yet, you were brought back to reality, as I recall, by an agent responding to a novel that you had sent in. Do you remember what the agent said?
Yes, I do, very well. It was burned into my brain. Yes, I sent this novel in. It was my first novel, and I got in about 150 pages, and I thought, this is the great American novel, clearly, and it's time that I shared it with the populace at large, you know. So.
This was after publishing one short story, right?
Two.
Oh, two, yeah. Oh, okay, well, then.
Two. And I sort of waited around the post office like a village idiot for days and weeks, and waiting for Hollywood to call and everything, you know. And this package came back, and an ill-wrapped package at that, and I realized it had my manuscript in it. I never wanted to see that again. I thought it was on its way to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, you know. And this note, and this is the entire note. Dear Peter, James Fenimore Cooper wrote this 150 years ago, only he wrote it better. Yours, Bernice. And that was the whole...
That was it.
That was the note. That was a smart pill. And in a way, that probably was a great novel. But she really knocked me right off my perch for that. And I put it on the shelf, and I don't know whatever became of it. I never went back. But
no, that would be a little scary. Well, now you wrote about, in one of your books, you wrote about when you were a teenager encountering a dead man in an alley, and how that just sort of gripped you, and I'm just wondering, was that the beginning of your seeing people who needed to be spoken for?
No, the beginning was really, I went to boarding school. I was raised in a very sheltered way, and I didn't know anything about, you know, I just wasn't very bright about these things or open. And when I was 13, though, I volunteered at school. They were sponsoring a charity, a boys' camp, for really very, very poor kids from New Haven, from the slums there. And they said, they asked for counselors, and I volunteered with a friend of mine. He and I went together and did it. And I think I got a real smart pill, because I remember the very first evening, and these kids came in on a bus, and they were really poor, and they were rough kids. They were tough, too. But mainly, they broke your heart, you know. And they laid on a big spread for them. They had all kinds of hot dogs and hamburgers and corn on the cob, and they really put it out there on the table, you know. And these kids didn't eat it. They attacked it. I mean, they really went for it. And all the time, I noticed they were all doing this. I think it was maybe the first meal they ever had where there wasn't an uncle or a bigger brother or somebody taking that food away from them. They stuffed themselves with poor little guys, and they were all sick all night long. It was all, the whole camp was like, and it really kind of woke me up. And then I began to realize that, you know, I'd lived a very sheltered life, and my parents were very, very nice people and very fair and very generous about everything, but they lived a very, very sheltered life. And I started, at that age, 13, I started splitting away. Even when I was in school, I started to get in trouble and protest certain things. And, I never looked back. I always went that way. So when I started writing, that's what I started writing about, that kind of thing.
Now, also, when you were young, you have said that you were always keeping lists of things.
I did.
Is this one of those obsessive compulsive things, or were you...
I think I already had a nervous twitch in my arm and had to get going. I just kept lists. I don't know what it was. I think it was not probably something deeply neurotic. I don't really know what that was. It just...
But don't you think that's contributed to your ability to observe, and at the end of the day, you kind of take note of what you've seen that day?
Yeah.
Good answer.
When I'm in the field working, I do take notes, and I have my little note taking system, which I forgot to say that this afternoon. We had a great group this afternoon of young writers, aspirant writers here, and we had a good meeting with them. And one thing I wanted to recommend to any new writer was my note taking, the Peter Matheson Jiffy technique, you know. But it really works very, very well indeed. I always wear shirts, those shirts with two big pockets here, and they'll hold those breast pocket notebooks, you know. And if you go to a surplus store, you can usually find old Fish and Wildlife Service notebooks that are rainproof, and they're great, even if you can't find them. But those square Husky notebooks, keep two of them, and all day long, you're putting down little things. And if you're like my writing, you have to write them up that night because you won't be able to read them by the next day, and especially if it was raining, you know, you lose them. So I have these things, and I listen, and you just don't know quite. Sometimes you don't know where you're going to use it. Sometimes I heard a line, and I actually have used the line now in my Watson books, my novels. I was in the Okefenokee Swamp. I was studying cranes, the sandhill cranes down there, and you have them here in California, too, a lot of them. And in the cypress, these huge cypress trees and the silence, and I was in this old boat, and I ran into an old guy in a rowboat. He was going the other way. And you saw his old flat-bottom skiff. You knew he'd made that boat. That was a homemade boat, if ever I saw one, you know. And it had kind of old beer cans rolling around the bottom, and his baits were all dried up there on the seat. They were dry baits, you know. And he obviously hadn't had much of a day out there with the fish. And as he was coming along, he rested on his oars just to coast past me, and he said, "You seen any fish around here might care for a ride in my boat?" And I thought, I don't know how I'm going to use that, but I'll put that to you. And those are the little kind of things. You can generally remember the events, but it's the little things that illustrate the event, that distill the event into one little thing that says it all. Mm-hmm. Saul Steinberg, you know him, the cartoonist. He's much more than a cartoonist. He's a great artist, really. He did those New Yorker covers, and these wonderful, wild imagination drawings, and technically superb drawings. And he was a friend. He was actually a Zen. He came to my Zendo quite a lot. And a brilliant guy. And I've forgotten how the conversation came around. We were talking about his home village in Hungary, where he came from. And he suddenly said something, and he got the whole village in one sentence. I was telling him from things he said, and I said, "Saul, you should be a writer. You have a wonderful precision and economy. You find just the right thing that captures it." And what he said was, I came from the sort of village where the geese walking by can look in the window.
What does that mean?
No, it just means that first of all, it's a farm village, and there are geese walking around the village, which there are in those villages. Second of all, you probably had a rather poor house because, and maybe only one floor, if the windows were low enough so a goose could look in and see what was going on. I don't know. I got the whole, the minute he said it, I've been in that part of the world a little bit. And I got the whole village. That's all he had to say, you know.
Amazing. Now you have been all over the world. You've been in the Antarctica. You've been in South America. You've trekked through the Himalayas. You've been with different tribes throughout the world. And it strikes me that you were one of the early sort of extreme outside writers. I mean, you've been in cages that have been attacked by great white sharks. Did you ever think to yourself while you were in the middle of one of those writing excursions, what was I thinking? You know, I could die out here. Did that ever occur to you?
It does occur to you, indeed. And I am not an extreme adventurer. I don't like being afraid. I don't like being physically afraid. And you put yourself in those situations, you're going to get scared a few times. You can't help it. But the stories were so exciting. I mean, imagine going down and seeing huge great white sharks off Australia underwater. That actually turned out not to be very dangerous. Sometimes the danger is overrated. Usually the danger comes from something that you couldn't possibly have planned on. One time I was in the South Sudan. I was hitchhiking down from Khartoum all the way. I wanted to go to Uganda. I wanted to see the Serengeti Plains, which at that time was very hard to get to.
And not many people just hitchhike to Uganda.
I came all the way down from the Aswan Dam in Egypt, and I came down and I got to Khartoum, and then I got on top of a market truck that was carrying bed ends and all kinds of rough ironware down into the heart of Africa, you know. And there were about 17 young guys were on the top of that cargo, and I think 14 of them were African kids, and three whites. I was one of the whites, and a hippie from L.A. was one too. He'd just been in Israel. He'd been fighting the Arabs over there, he said, and he was absolutely passionate, you know, Zionist. And he very nearly got us killed. He really did, because he hated the drivers of the truck were Arabs. And all this guy did was insult them. He'd show them the notches on his knife, and he'd say, "That's a couple of your guys I got there." Yeah. And he was very, very funny. He's one of the funniest guys I've ever come across. He claimed that he was a great friend of Mort Sahl. I won't go into the things he said, but they were comical. And it wasn't really him that got us in serious trouble, although he extended it. We were in the very most southernmost town in the Sudan, right on the Uganda border. We were trying to catch a ride down into Uganda. And the people there, it was called Nimuli. And Nimuli, they were so proud of their little village. It was on the Blue Nile. It was beautiful. And they had a little park across the river and had white rhinos and stuff you didn't see many places. And we'd walk over there, the askaris, you could walk into the park. In the old days, you could do that. You do it carefully, but you can do it. And the third day, and they said, "This is the crossroads of the world. There's traffic pouring through here every day. You guys won't have any trouble getting a ride." Well, not a single vehicle went through the first 2 days. Not even one went through that border station. And on the third night, we were going over to the little park every day because no vehicles were coming. And they said, "Well, if they come, we'll blow a horn or we'll stop them long enough." And this is what we think they said, because we didn't speak any Sudanese. But they seemed to be saying something really friendly like that. And I also befriended, and I think this was maybe what saved our life. I befriended a young guy there who had been somewhere, and he'd been studying French, and I spoke French. And he was trying out his French, and he and I would practice his French. I never saw him again after the crisis began. He'd vanished like a ghost, you know. But what happened was that suddenly, the people started yelling at us, and we were camped outside on the road edge, outside the stockade that was on the border post there. And we were suddenly taken prisoner. We were just taken in, and we didn't have any food. We didn't have, even getting the water was tough, you know. And for, I don't know, for about 12 hours to 20, we all thought we were going to be executed or killed in some way or another. People were so angry, and they're pointing at us. And Africans are wonderful people. They're extremely generous and funny and nice and kind, and I just think they're great. But they're very volatile. They get excited, and boy, oh boy, you don't want to be around it, because it can very easily turn into something kind of violent. And so we didn't know what had happened, how it had happened, or what had made them so angry. That was one of the worst parts about it. We didn't know what the hell was going on. And about the end of the third day, one of them came forward and said, and he invited us to eat out of the common bowl. Well, unfortunately, they were having these tripes. And the tripes had been prepared in a very ancient green sauce. I don't know where the green came from, but you didn't have much faith that you weren't going to die at once. And in fact, my hippie partner, he had a beret and big shades on, and earrings, and a big knife in his belt, and the works. And he said, "I'm not going to eat that." I said, "Well, you have to eat it. You have to eat it. This could be." And the third guy was a young South African guy. He knew what was going on too. And we both said, "You have to eat this, because refusing people's food is unforgivable in this situation." So me and the South African kid, and he went and was sick. I had an iron stomach in those days due to all my. I managed to get some down. This guy just buffaloed these guys. He was just sitting there. He would not eat it. He had his big earrings and his. And they were spooked by him, and we got away with it. But anyway, I'm getting off here, as I tend to do so. I want to say that what had happened, the next morning there was a truck that came through, and we got on it and got across into Uganda and took a deep breath for the first time, really, in days. What had happened, there was, of course, a great leader in Zaire, in the Congo, named Patrice Lumumba. Lumumba, you younger guys aren't going to remember, but the older ones will. He was a firebrand. And we kind of offed him with RCIA and then the Belgian mining interests. A lot of people wanted to get rid of Lumumba because he was too much trouble, and he was a real revolutionary and a real independent, you know. And he had been assassinated that night. And the word went around Africa like a fire. Mm-hmm. And I think this figure, something like 240 white people were killed that night in Africa. You know, just a wily, a lashing out, a rage. These people knew he was a real leader, and that, you know, he should not have been. And we were.
Could have been you.
It could have been us. Yeah, it was as close as that. Well, you can't anticipate a thing
right.
like that. You know, as a very long-winded way of saying you can't anticipate trouble. Sorry about that.
Yeah. All right. Now, you have said that it wasn't until you were age 40 that you wrote what you really wanted.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It means that I couldn't afford to really stick to my guns and write only what I wanted to write about. I wasn't supporting my family. I had a wife and two little children, and I worked I ran a deep sea fishing boat, and I worked on commercial wholesaling fishing crews. I did a lot of things on the side to make money, because I wasn't making enough as a writer.
Okay.
I was getting good reviews, but you can't eat reviews. So.
See, yeah, that's right. The way I interpreted that statement from you, though, was maybe it wasn't until you were 40 and you had some experience and you had kind of developed your own voice that then you were getting to be able to say what you really wanted to say. But
well, I tell you what, my work got a lot better once that heat was off. I wasn't, you know, trying to balance everything. I think what kicked me over the line, I'm sorry to say, was a big movie contract for a novel called At Play in the Fields of the Lord that came. It was actually made 25 years later. It came out a few years ago. And that was a big chunk of money, and I put money aside to educate my kids. And then I felt I was in the clear. I could do what I wanted. I didn't mind, you know, living simply. And then things started to happen, and I hooked up with the New Yorker. That was good too. They paid very well. They paid very well. So that made a big difference.
Okay. Now we've just got a couple of minutes left. Tell me, from all of the places you've been, all the things you've seen, there's a common thread among all peoples that you've experienced where they love to tell stories. That stories are somehow part of us. Why is that? Why do we need stories?
Well, the story tradition is everywhere, and not only, it's not just because they're entertaining, they're very valuable. I mean, they keep people, imagine before you had electricity and lights and TV and whatever, radio or anything, and people had the long, long winter to go through. And in North America, it was a very strong tradition too. And you, in fact, in some tribes, you're not allowed to tell stories in the good season where there's plenty of food and plenty to eat and hunt and everything, that you're supposed to save those stories for those desperate times, you know, when you have nothing else to kind of entertain people. So they really do value. And then, of course, those stories, they finally become part of the tribe. They really are just kind of manifesting. And then they really are legends and myths that go down and down and down. They're hardly changed at all after that, after they reach that mythic, you know, kind of quality. But I remember we were with a tribe in New Guinea, a war tribe, and they went to war about once a week. These guys, they're amazing.
It's Monday.
Well, it was kind of like,
Guess we better invade.
No, it was really more like a football game. They weren't like us. One person was enough. They killed one guy, the war was over. Both sides had a feast. One side was crying all during the feast, and the other side was, yeah, you know. But it was a very civilized group. But they, what was I talking about?
I don't know, but I've got to wrap this up. So I want you to give us, I want you to give the would-be writers in our audience, I want you to give them your best summary of advice, writing advice.
You really have to write. You can't wait for the muse. You got to put in, you got to get your ass on that seat and get to it. You do, and then the good moments will come, and you're very grateful for them. But if you wait till you feel like writing, oh no, I don't feel. You know, forget it. You're not gonna. It comes in the process. That's how you learn. That's how you, and that and the other thing, of course, is the reading. You have to read, really. Hemingway had one very good piece of advice, excellent piece of advice. He said, never quit writing for the day when you know exactly what you're going to do. Oh, no, is it the other way?
He said stop in the middle.
Don't hit an easy patch and then write and get it done with and say, okay, now it's time for the dry martini. No, you shouldn't do that. You should save that easy one to get you cranked up in the morning. And that is very valuable, because sometimes getting cranked up in the morning is very hard.
Because, and didn't he say, to continue the Hemingway point, he said, start, end in the middle of a problem, or set
no,
up...
No, no,
no.
No, no, he said...
Oh, that must have been me.
He said, deal with the problem. That's why you're in such trouble.
That's right. Peter Matheson, thank you so much for being with us tonight.